It's been a week since a fire damaged the Daniel Carter Beard Bridge in Cincinnati. What do we know about what fueled the flames, and how long will it take to make repairs? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll discuss the latest on the Big Mac Bridge. We'll also delve into the school board members' concerns about a Cincinnati Public Schools restructuring plan, and we'll hear about WVXU's latest community dispatch, reports from New Richmond. Joining me now to talk about the fire that damaged the Big Mac Bridge are Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight. Welcome back, Cameron.
Thanks for having me.
And WCPO9 I-Team reporter Paula Christian. Thanks so much for joining us, Paula.
Thank you, Lucy.
It's been a week since this fire that just raged and damaged the Daniel Carter Beard Bridge, otherwise known as the Big Mac Bridge. Cameron, what did it look like on the scene last Friday morning when you got there?
So I was there around sunrise, and the big bulk of the flames had died down at that point. However, it was reigniting a bunch of times throughout the morning, so there was still smoke rising from the scene when I got there. And once I was able to approach the bridge closer to see sort of what was happening underneath, it was just completely charred. And blackened. The underneath of the bridge was blackened. The playground there where the fire likely started was totally charred. Everything was just black. It was pretty and smoldering. And throughout the morning there were some reignitions. So the fire started around 2:30, and I probably got there around 8, and there was a huge reignition at that point where they had to go back in, start dumping water on it again, and big plumes of smoke were coming up again, even that far on. So that had been 6-7 hours at that point, you know.
Cameron, what do we know about why the fire burned so hot that it could damage the bridge?
They haven't given an exact reason why it was particularly hot or big, but they did mention multiple times that there was a lot of synthetic material in the playground, and the entire ground of the playground, for lack of a better term, what would have maybe been at other playgrounds mulch or something like that, was actually a synthetic padding material, which you might be familiar with if you go to playgrounds a lot. They have this like padded ground material they use. And while I'm not familiar with the flammability of it or anything like that, I'm not familiar with the science of it. I imagine if it does catch, it would probably be quite a bad fire. So, and a lot of the equipment at that playground was also made of apparently synthetic materials.
Paula, did the Federal Highway Administration kind of see this coming?
They sure did. They issued a memo almost exactly a year ago after a very catastrophic bridge closure on the Santa Monica Freeway in Los Angeles. They sent a memo out to all of the state departments of transportation warning them to check underneath bridges and ramps for any kind of flammable material, construction debris, pallets, hazardous material, things like that that could ignite, and saying that it needed to be taken care of immediately. They did specify, you know, some structures that can be made of combustible materials such as wood or plastic, but they didn't specify anything like playgrounds. So when I spoke to the Ohio Department of Transportation spokesperson, they said, you know, yeah, we got that memo. We circulated it to all 12 districts in Ohio and our engineers. And, you know, we had people checking for, you know, the things we thought they meant, like construction debris and pallets and, you know, maybe debris left behind from homeless encampments. But they weren't looking at playgrounds.
And Paula, do you know more about what this playground was made of? What kind of materials were used in its construction that were so flammable?
Well, I spoke to Casey Jones, who is an engineer based out of Kansas City. He's an expert in bridge construction, and he has a YouTube channel where he features all kinds of interesting like events related to bridges. And he spotlighted, what happened here twice. So I reached out to him, I talked to him, and he said the playground, things like rubber and plastic, they're petroleum based and they're highly flammable. And he said when he watched the video, it looked like somebody had, set a blowtorch to it, or it looked like a gas tanker had exploded. That's how flammable it is. And he said that the playgrounds like this are highly flammable, and that, people need to really take a look at what is being placed under bridges and ramps, especially when it's such a major bridge like the Big Mac Bridge that carries 100,000 vehicles a day.
I guess, and we should mention that no one was injured in this fire, which is pretty remarkable. Cameron, I understand the cause of the fire is still unknown. Who's going to be in charge of investigating that?
So at the moment, it's the Cincinnati Police Department, Cincinnati Fire Department, excuse me, that's investigating it. They are able to call in national resources and the state fire marshal, and they have other resources at their disposal if they need them. But they're the ones leading the investigation right now. And from what we can tell, well, from what they talked to me about, it could take weeks, it could take quite a long time. It's a very scientific process, and they emphasize that unless there's some sort of scientific certainty about why the fire started and exactly how it happened, then a lot of times it will be left undetermined until they're able to figure that out. Whether the fire department decides to make other statements ruling things out, like, oh, we've determined that it wasn't this or something like that, that's kind of up to their discretion, but that's who is leading the investigation at the moment.
What kind of training do those investigators have, Cameron?
They go through a lot of training. We have 9 members on our fire investigation unit in Cincinnati, and after they're not even allowed to try to get into the program until they've been a firefighter for about 4 years, which requires its own set of lots of training. All of our firefighters take EMS training as well, so they're all fire EMS people. And then they're able to take an exam to go enter into the position of fire investigator. And then that requires them to become basically full-fledged police officers on top of being firefighters. So they go to the Cincinnati Police Academy and go through all of their training. They become certified law enforcement officials in Ohio. And then they go on to a national academy for learning all the intricacies of the trade, from gathering evidence to presenting it at trial and all of that. So that whole process takes quite a long time, and then there's another certification they can get on top of it after they've been a firefighter for at least 4 years, and then been an investigator for another 4 years. They can get another, like, international certification. And 8 of the 9 people in our unit in Cincinnati have that extra certification as well.
Paula, this expert that you talked to, did he talk to you at all about kind of what he would look for in terms of investigating? I mean, I know he's not a fire investigator, he's more of a bridge expert, but what are the things that he was really honed in on?
He seemed to think that it had to be arson because, it just how hot it burned, how quickly it burned. Now, he's not a fire investigator, but he certainly follows bridge fires and bridge accidents and, seeing how, I mean, he talked to me in detail about how hot of a temperature would have to be to damage those steel girders. And it's, several thousand degrees. So he just thought there had to be some kind of accelerant used, and that it had to be arson. Interestingly, the Cincinnati Parks Department has had several fires in local parks over the last couple of weeks. On their Facebook page, they were posting just a couple of weeks ago some little fires that were started, I believe, in Ault Park and Winton Woods, and just saying, hey, this is not allowed. If anybody sees somebody setting a fire, please notify authorities. So we reached out to the park, well, actually, several people on the park department's Facebook page after the bridge fire said, well, wait a minute, is this related? You've got fires, being set in other parks. We asked Cincinnati Parks spokesperson about it, and he said, with he didn't want to get involved in the investigation of firefighters, but he said he highly doubts that they are connected, that they get little fires in parks all the time, and these are more like campfire kind of fires and not, what was destroyed underneath the bridge.
Sure. And Paula, this expert you talked about who said he's suspicious that maybe arson played a role in this, he hasn't been to the scene, right? This is based on what he's seen in videos and that sort of thing.
Yes, no, he's several hundred miles away. He's literally watching our coverage and he's watching the TV videos and he's, it's pure speculation on his part. But that was his guess. And, he also said it's not out of the realm of possibility that, people do set playgrounds on fire in other places. It's happened, and that going forward, that obviously officials need to really start taking a look at other playgrounds or other structures that are placed under bridges and ramps that, maybe nobody even ever thought that this could catch on fire. It's definitely going to be like a case study for sure.
Cameron, have you heard anybody that you've talked to from the fire department or local officials talk about the possibility of arson? Is that something that's come up?
At the scene, the fire department folks have been saying they're not going to rule, they haven't ruled anything out. Again, I don't know if maybe in the next few weeks they will say, oh, we have ruled this out, but we still don't know what it is. But at the scene, the assistant chief and the chief on the scene were very much like we're looking for any and everything. So yeah, it's not they definitely have not ruled arson out as of yet, at least not publicly. So it's still on the table, I believe. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they find when they finally do all the science down there and figure out if there were any accelerants and all of that kind of stuff.
Paula, you mentioned that this expert said this could end up being a case study based on the way this playground burned and what it did to the bridge. Did he say anything about whether this should lead other communities to think about whether it's problematic to have playgrounds under bridges, whether that's something, folks should think twice about?
Absolutely. I mean, he's hoping that there's some lessons to be learned here, that officials start taking a look at playgrounds, other structures that are built with wood, plastic, rubber, that, could be set on fire, could catch fire. They should not be underneath bridges and ramps, especially when it's a major bridge like the Big Mac Bridge. And I also asked him because there's so many cars parked under bridges and ramps, in downtown Cincinnati. And I asked him about that, should the cars be parked there? Now, in theory, he said, well, those absolutely could catch on fire. He just thinks that he's kind of a purist when it comes to infrastructure. He just thinks that public officials are under a lot of pressure to find extra space for things like parks and, and so they're looking for extra space in places maybe they shouldn't, which is underneath bridges and ramps.
Cameron, the bridge and I-471 were closed for a while after the fire. What parts of the bridge have reopened?
So it's my understanding that the I'm gonna get mixed up here and say the wrong thing. One of the I believe the northbound lanes have reopened, southbound remains closed, and there are still a bunch of the entrance ramps, like to get on to 471 from the Ohio side of the river, are still closed. And but the again the northbound side is open, and then 471 down further into Kentucky has reopened as well.
And as I mentioned at the top of the show, Governor Mike DeWine declared a state of emergency in Hamilton County after the fire. My understanding is that could open up the opportunity for other types of funding to make these repairs that the bridge will need. Cameron, what have Ohio Department of Transportation officials said about how long it could take to make these repairs? I mean, a lot of us were around in 2020 when there was that big fire on the Brent Spence Bridge that was such a mess, closed that down. That took a while.
Yeah, and they have and a while is about as specific as anyone has gotten. Unfortunately, I think the last update that we had from our reporter Patricia Newberry was that they were trying to source the materials that they were going to need to do the repair, everything they needed to do. And once they had sourced those materials and figured out the cost and figured out how long it would take for them to get here and all of that kind of stuff, then they would have a much clearer idea of how long it would take. Right now, the talk is like weeks, but is that 3 weeks? Is it 12 weeks? Is it no, people haven't gotten very specific with it yet.
And Paula, you talked to this expert. You all have at the I-Team's been looking into this Federal Highway Administration alert. What else are you going to be watching for with this as repairs begin and the investigation continues?
Well, I want to chime in just briefly. I asked my bridge expert, my engineering expert, how long he thought it was going to take for the repairs to be done.
Sure.
And he said at the absolute minimum, 8 weeks.
Ah.
And that is only if the steel girders need to be replaced. If the concrete piers need to be replaced, it's an additional several weeks on top of that. He just described how they have to, there's a line of people, waiting for these steel products to get cut. And so in emergencies, they'll let them kind of jump the line to get the steel girders cut. But and he did praise the Great Lakes, I think it was Great Lakes Construction, the company that was chosen to do the repairs. He said they were a very heavy hitter and they would do quick work and be able to perhaps get this expedited. But he seemed to think this was going to be a very long closure. Oh, and but we will be looking at other things related to this. Just mainly like how it happened and if there was any warning that it could happen, that's what we'll be looking at.
Okay. Well, you have not given me hope for my commute for the next few weeks, Paula, but you're still my friend. I've been talking with WCPO9 I-Team reporter Paula Christian and Cincinnati Inquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks for
Thank
having
you,
us.
Lucy.
Up next, we'll discuss the latest on a Cincinnati Public Schools plan to move students and address both overcrowding and under-enrollment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Some Cincinnati school board members have expressed concern about a major restructuring plan that's been proposed for the district. Joining me now to explain those concerns and discuss some other news from the past week is WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thanks for being here, Zach. Welcome back.
Always good to be here, Lucy.
Always great to have you. I mentioned some members of the Board of Education for Cincinnati Public Schools have concerns about this redistricting plan that we talked about last week. This is a cruel question, but can you remind us briefly what this plan would do, how many schools it would affect?
I can. So what this plan is, this is phase two of the redistricting plan. So phase one was merging some schools, moving some schools to other buildings. And basically what they're trying to do is balance enrollment and kind of increase efficiency in their buildings. So phase two is doing more of the same. Phase two is what they're talking about right now. And what it would do, it would take what they did in phase one and expand it to a much larger scale. So we're looking at nearly 30 CPS schools being impacted by this. So this is going to be merging some elementary schools together and, you know, taking the students that were at one elementary school, putting them in another, and using that other elementary school building to become middle schools. So we're looking at possibly six new middle schools being created out of this, taking students out of several high schools, that's seventh and eighth graders, taking them out of high school buildings, putting them into new middle school buildings. And it's doing this across the district. So this is impacting east, west, central, kind of everywhere.
All over the place. Why does the district's interim superintendent say it's important to do this now?
Well, it is kind of a cost-saving thing, but also kind of a necessary retooling of the district to balance that enrollment. You know, right now the district has several schools that are kind of being underutilized, under-enrolled. They don't have, you know, really enough students, you know, to fill their capacity. And in other cases, like at many of the high schools, they have overcrowding, too many students in the building for what they can really do right now. So really it's to balance enrollment, kind of, you know, increase efficiency in some of these buildings. And the administration, you know, this is going to be a pretty expensive plan, right? It's going to be over $200 million to do kind of everything that they want to do here. But, you know, the superintendent has said that this is going to be broken down over years, so it's not going to be all $2 million in 1 year. And honestly,
$200 million
yeah. in 1 year, so it'll be spread out. And they really want this to be cost neutral. You know, kind of making these moves will increase efficiency, so they say, and you know, kind of mitigate those costs a little bit.
And she wants to get it done pretty quickly, right?
Yeah. She wants to get it done pretty quickly, as soon as fall of 2025. So that is, at this point, half of a school year and the summer months to get this done. So there is not a lot of time to do this because it's a lot of schools involved in this. But the administration and also some members of the school board have mentioned that there could be some external pressure kind of forcing these things right now. You know, on Monday, they talked about Senate Bill 295, which is, you know, a bill being introduced in the State House currently, and it's in the very early stages, and right now the wording of it is very vague. So it's not totally clear what that bill could turn out to be, but certainly now that it's after the election, the state legislators are going to be in lame duck session for the next few months, and they're really concerned about this bill passing and kind of forcing their hand. And what Senate Bill 295 would do was it would revise an existing Ohio law that requires school districts to sell their buildings if they're being underutilized. And what that is 60%. Now, what that 60% means isn't really clear in the existing law. So they pointed to, and they meaning members of the school district and members of the school board pointed to a Fordham Institute recommendation from earlier this year, which would, you know, really incentivize legislators to develop this bill and kind of reinforce and revise some of those existing laws. So this could mean a number of different things. This could really mean forcing school districts to report their kind of enrollment in these schools in a more centralized way, so the state can facilitate, you know, possibly auctioning off and selling these buildings. And, you know, there's also the possibility of kind of doing this based off of an existing Indiana law, which would force school districts to sell certain unused buildings for a dollar. So
a dollar.
Yeah.
Wow. And would this be possibly selling them to charter schools?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what it would be. It would be kind of getting the wheels turning on something that would kind of force districts to use these older buildings or unused buildings and sell them to charter schools.
Interesting. Some board members raised concerns about this plan, as I've mentioned. What did board member Ben Lindy have to say? What's he worried about with this?
Really, he's worried about the kind of sweeping nature and speed of this kind of plan. Like we said, this is 30 schools that are being impacted by this. So to do that in the span of now less than a year, it's a lot. And he's worried that this is going to turn off a lot of parents and a lot of students because, you know, you're taking students who were in one school and kind of settled there and expecting to be there for a while, and you're kind of uprooting them and moving them to another school. So the scope of this and the speed of this is what people are worried about. And certainly they're worried that doing all of these changes all at once is going to drive people away from the school district.
Is that what board member Brandon Craig is concerned about too?
Yeah, yeah. Brandon Craig brought that up. He is, you know, concerned about, you know, with Ohio's school voucher program and the rise of charter schools. They're really worried about students leaving the district. They're saying that there's so many things now incentivizing public school students and public school families to leave their local school districts. And, you know, I will say, you know, with Senate Bill 295, this is going to impact a lot of other school districts as well. You know, it's not just Cincinnati right now considering these kinds of changes. When you look at Cleveland, Columbus, they all have this issue right now with under-enrolled school buildings where they're not meeting that 60% threshold. So currently right now, Cincinnati is working on something like this. Cleveland, Columbus, Middletown, Dublin near Columbus as well. They're all going through redistricting plans trying to balance the enrollment. So this is a statewide thing kind of happening everywhere.
Yeah. And now you mentioned that this phase two covers up to roughly 30 schools. Does that mean there are some students who had to move as part of phase one who might have to move again as part of phase two?
Yeah. So this, there would be some students, I believe, who, you know, would have gone to a new building this year and would be going to another building next year. Also, certainly with turning elementary schools into middle schools, you're going to have some situations where a student is going to an elementary school, gets moved to another elementary school, graduates from that elementary school, and is going to go back to their old elementary school, but as a middle school student. Wow. So that is also kind of potentially going to happen here as well. So there, that means like a lot of shuffling, a lot of students going, bouncing from different schools, sometimes, you know, three schools in the course of 3 years. So yeah, a lot of shuffling happening here.
Yeah. Has the Cincinnati Teachers Union taken a position on this whole thing?
They seem to be behind this plan, supporting it, trying to get the wheels moving on it. Julie Sellers, the president, she spoke at the meeting and says, you know, whatever happens here, you're going to have to make a decision on this soon. With a big plan like this, you need time to actually put it in action. So, you know, approve it or not. You know, she's really hoping for the school board to make a decision on this soon, and especially with stuff from the state and so many other factors. There's really a lot of pressure to push something like this through, but really the school board members have a lot of questions. They're really worried about feeling pressured to do this, and they're worried about people in the community feeling like they're pressured to support this because they have to.
Yeah. Well, I know you've been following this very closely and will continue to. I'll also mention Cincinnati Public Schools is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Zach, another big story you've been covering for months relates to the troubles with the former Union Institute and University. It closed in June. Now former students tell you their struggles aren't over. Why is that?
Well, students are, former students now, are having trouble accessing their transcripts. So this is affecting not only students that were enrolled when the university was closing, but students who were enrolled years ago, sometimes decades ago. They're sometimes looking for new opportunities, either in their careers or in education. I spoke to one former student that graduated in 2014, and she says that she is looking looking for a promotion at her job. She's been in law enforcement for a very long time, and she was due for a promotion, and she's kind of at the end of her career, she says, and kind of really needed this promotion and required a master's degree for it. Now, when she tried to enroll in a master's degree program, they required this transcript from Union, and she went, she tried to get it, but really there was nothing, no way for her to receive or even request it. When you look at Union Institute's website, they have a link to request and order your transcript. But when you click that link, it takes you to Parchment, a company that facilitates these kinds of things. And it has a message that reads that Union Institute is closed and they will not process these requests because of the closure. Now, before Union Institute closed earlier this year, you could actually request your transcripts through Parchment, but it appears that since the university closed, whatever deal that they had with Parchment to send out these transcripts is dissolved and kind of gone now. I messaged Parchment about this and they said, you know, it's really on Union Institute to do this. They can't do it without, you know, their a deal being made. And I also spoke to the Ohio Department of Higher Education that's saying that they've been trying to work with Union Institute to find some way to make these transcripts available to people, because now it's affecting, you know, so many different students. And of course, this is an online school, predominantly online. So this is affecting students across the country who went there and really didn't even know that the school had closed. And they're only finding out about kind of everything that has happened once they request their transcripts. So this is, you know, it's affecting a lot of people.
Has anyone from Union Institute talked with you about this and explained or said, here's what we're going to do to help students? What have you heard from them? Anything?
Not a peep. And honestly, nobody really has. When speaking to Parchment or the state or former students who have tried to reach out to, you know, the leaders at Union Institute, there's been no response. Obviously, now the school is closed, so you can't get a hold of like a office employee or somebody like that. So you kind of have to reach out for the leaders who have been kind of facilitating the closure. And, you know, I've tried to call them, I've sent them emails, and I don't get any response. Former students don't get any response. It's really hard to get a hold of them. And it seems like it's not just me, it's not just students, it's kind of everybody. So really, Union Institute does have the power to get these transcripts out, but they're not doing it and they're not answering questions right now.
So where does that leave graduates of Union Institute like this woman you talked to? I mean, you know, I never requested a transcript for where I went to college. My place is still in business, fortunately. But I mean, where does that leave people? I think you graduate and just assume that if you need that, you can get it down the road.
There's not really a ton of avenues right now. Really, what I can recommend is file a complaint with the Ohio Department of Higher Education. They're taking complaints right now. I know a number of students have done that already. But, you know, it's one of those things, again, where it's really on Union to do this and they're not doing it. So you can apply some pressure through the state to do that. But at the same time, I mean, Union Institute is swamped with lawsuits and, you know, fines from the federal government totaling millions of dollars. So, you know, another fine, how much of a difference will that really make? Pressure from another government institution, how much would that really do? We're not really sure. You know, there's been so many fines, so many lawsuits, and it hasn't really changed the reality for so many students.
Well, let's turn to Kentucky, where medical marijuana was on the ballot in a number of communities. How many communities in northern Kentucky asked voters whether they wanted to allow retail sales of medical cannabis in their communities?
Yeah, so 12 in total in the northern Kentucky region voted to approve these measures to welcome medical marijuana into their jurisdiction. So that is 10 in Kenton, Boone, and Campbell County, those major three northern Kentucky counties, and also two more in those other counties that are south of those three. So 12 in total. And I will say that this was on the ballot in 53 cities across Kentucky. all of them approved it. So all the cities in Northern Kentucky, all the counties in Northern Kentucky who had this on the ballot, and all 53 cities in Kentucky all voted to approve of this. So this is red counties, blue counties, everybody voted to approve this. So clearly Northern Kentucky, the rest of Kentucky showing big support for welcoming medical marijuana. And now we wait to see who will actually end up getting these dispensaries when they hold the lottery later this month.
When is that? Do you know? I mean, because there are a limited number of these dispensaries that will be opening based on kind of the way the state law and regulations are structured, right?
Yeah. So the lottery is going to be held November 25th. It'll be live streamed on YouTube. They actually meant to hold this lottery at the end of October. They did hold a lottery for processors and growers and things like that October 28th. They were supposed to do dispensaries then too. They postponed it because of the large number of applications. Now, we're talking about over 4,000 applicants statewide. And I think something like 300, almost 400 have applied in Northern Kentucky. And there's only going to be four winners out of there. So
four for the whole state?
Four for the Northern Kentucky region.
For Northern Kentucky, okay.
Yeah. So there will be, let's see, look at my notes here, 48 across the entire state,
okay.
Four in Northern Kentucky. So out of 400 applicants, almost 400 applicants in Northern Kentucky, four are going to get licenses to operate in the region. So a very small number for this first year. And, you know, the application process for this was pretty expensive. So a lot of companies put in thousands of dollars just to be in this lottery process. And they will go through that random selection at the end of the month, pick out those four. And, you know, we'll see where they land, because they had to pick a specific location in a specific city that would work as a dispensary. So all these companies that applied had to find a location, kind of get approval from whatever landlord, and kind of hope that either their city or county would approve a measure during election day to welcome them in. So certainly good news for those businesses that every city that had it on the ballot approved it, because certainly I couldn't imagine a situation where you spent thousands of dollars and found a location and were getting ready to set up shop, and the voters in that area didn't approve it. So we will actually find out where these end up being. Of course, a very high likelihood for Boone, Kenton, and Campbell County being one of those locations. But I do believe that it's really only one is going to operate in each county. So the possibility of, you know, all three counties getting one dispensary seems pretty likely.
Wow. Okay. Well, I have been talking with WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thanks so much for your time today, Zach.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we'll explore the latest community dispatch from New Richmond, Ohio. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. WVXU's latest community dispatch featured reports that explored the past, present, and future of New Richmond, Ohio. Joining me now to talk about the series is WVXU General Assignment and Long-Form Reporter Nick Swartzell. Welcome back, Nick.
Hey, Lucy. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How about you?
Pretty good.
Good, good, good. Nick, this was a wonderful bunch of stories about New Richmond, Indiana. That's part of our community dispatch series. You always do such a great job with these stories. Tell us why you decided to focus on New Richmond.
Yeah. So first, New Richmond's in Ohio. I also get it mixed up with Richmond, Indiana.
Oh, did I say New Richmond, Indiana?
Yes.
Oh,
Richmond, Indiana does roll off the tongue because we are so close to it. But
Lord,
it is,
I'm so sorry.
No,
there it is.
No, it's totally fine.
Thank you for correcting me.
Yeah. So New Richmond, Ohio is in Claremont County. It's about 20 miles away. It's a 20-minute drive or about an hour-long bike ride if you want to do that.
There you go.
I recommend it. It's great. And yeah, it's a really charming river town right on the Ohio River. Really a lot of history there and a lot of pride there too, I'd say.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, speaking of history, you talked to Mary Allen. She's on the Village Council. Tell us about her and how she's following in the footsteps of her, I believe it's her great-great-grandfather?
That's right. Yeah. So Mary Allen, yeah, she's on the Village Council. She's like really invested in this community that she grew up in. And yeah, she just has this really wonderful history. Her family's been there since the 1860s and has really invested a lot in the community. Her great-great-grandfather, Howell Boone, escaped or left slavery. It's kind of unclear the circumstances under which he left slavery and came to New Richmond because it was a place that was welcoming to Black people escaping slavery or leaving slavery at the time, and really kind of built a lot of the civic infrastructure there, especially for fellow Black people, and really made it a place where a lot of Black people settled. And he helped found a kind of like proto NAACP, kind of like a mutual aid organization that led to the founding of two Black churches. And yeah, Mary Ellen obviously is very proud of that history, and she's done all kinds of things herself to contribute to New Richmond.
Yeah. He was part of her great-great-grandfather. It became a pretty significant Black population in New Richmond for a while, wasn't it?
Yeah. And Mary Ellen has done a lot of research on this. She's gone back through the old census records and things like that. And in the years before and right after the Civil War, like one in five people in New Richmond were Black. And that is a very unusual thing for the time, especially in Ohio, right across the river from Kentucky.
Sure. And that's not how the community looks now, right? I mean, it's predominantly white right now. What did Mary Ellen have to say about that? Why does she think that is?
So she really ties it to economics. And she says, a lot of the reason besides sort of the abolitionist history of New Richmond, because it was a very strong abolitionist town, had to do with the fact there were a lot of mills, there was a lot of boat building going on, there was a lot of industry in New Richmond. And over time, we kind of centralized a lot of our employers in larger cities. And especially if you're not a person who has enough money to have a car back in the day when automobiles became really important, you wanted to kind of gravitate toward where the jobs were. And so she has that sort of as one part of the puzzle piece. I talked to a historian who knows a lot about New Richmond's history, who says there were some other things going on too, including this sort of after the Civil War, this backlash to, racial harmony and civil rights. And there was a racially charged lynching in New Richmond that happened that would have been legitimately scary for people of color there.
Sure. Well, let's talk about something happening in New Richmond now, kind of the present of New Richmond. I loved your piece on the butterfly garden there. Talk about that.
This was such a privilege to be able to do this story. So I was talking to the village administrator, and she just happened to mention, oh, and we've got this like butterfly garden going in and all this stuff. And she just kind of rattled it off. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. So I did a little bit of research into it. And the garden is a partnership between the village and this recovery. There are two recovery houses called On Our Way Home. And they help folks leaving addiction. And so the park is kind of put together and maintained by the folks who live in these and work in these recovery houses. And it's through a grant that the village and Claremont County got. And the idea is that they've taken this space that had been flooded out in the 90s. New Richmond experiences a lot of flooding over the years and had since that time become kind of a informal junkyard. It was like a dumping ground. Cleaned it all up, got some shrubs in that are going to grow bigger and become these sort of like pollinator habitats. And basically, it's going to attract a lot of butterflies. And there was a ceremony releasing the first round of butterflies. It was really beautiful, and it was great.
Yeah. It sounds so symbolic, too. It's this transformation, from the caterpillar to the butterfly, just like people are working to kind of transform their own lives as they, come out of addiction and problems with substances. So it was just a beautiful story.
Yeah, thanks. I enjoyed it because there were a couple layers to it. In addition to the individual recovery of folks who were trying to find, turn a new page in life and move on to the next thing, there's this piece of land that had basically had a destroyed house on it and some other destroyed houses around it that is also being reborn and repurposed and the symbol of renewal in that way too.
Yeah. Well, because of the flooding that New Richmond experiences from time to time, right?
I mean, exactly.
That's a huge part of its, if it's kind of history there. Okay. Well, we're just talking about the river. Speaking of the river, the village has a big project in the works. Tell us about Liberty Landing.
Yeah. So the village got, I think it's $13.4 million from the state of Ohio in this Appalachian Community Grant. New Richmond, by the way, is right on the border of Appalachia and Claremont County. Claremont County is like the first county in Ohio that's Appalachian. I've asked people there whether they feel like it's an Appalachian place, and they say yes and no, kind of, you know. But anyway, they got this grant for $13.4 million to redo their riverfront. Now, the riverfront right now is cool. I like it. I think it's really cool. But it's just kind of like a sandy beach for the most part. And then there's like a promenade up the hill a little way where you can walk. But what their vision is, you know, a place where bigger boats can dock, maybe some of them stay as restaurants or entertainment, and a place that draws tourists, basically. And they want to, they call it Liberty Landing. And I've heard that the reason it's called that is they want to play up the sort of history of abolition and folks fleeing slavery across the Ohio River as like, this is a spot that's historic, but also today you can come and see that history and also have a good time.
Yeah. Well, and what, when do these, the village administrators, the folks who are working on this, when do they think work could start on this? It sounds like it could be a pretty big deal for the village.
Yeah. So right now they're in the sort of planning phases of this, and they're going to be doing some more community input sessions and things like that. And they're not exactly sure when everything is going to be done, but they really would like to break ground early next year. So they're moving fast. What I've been told is the planning phase is like getting pretty close. They're almost finished, and they're going to present kind of the final version of it to the residents and get some feedback and then adjust and then get started.
Okay. Well, you have so many more stories. We've only got about a minute left, but pick another one you want to talk about for the
yes.
next minute.
So I also talked to folks who used to work at Beckjord Power Plant, which is in New Richmond, was in New Richmond, and Zimmer Power Plant, which is a little ways away in Moscow, but it employed a lot of people in the village. And it was just really interesting. Talking to those folks was really great. They had a lot of really good perspective on both the economic value of those plants, but also the impact when they close down, but also like the future. Like they're coal-fired power plants. You would expect folks who worked in a coal-fired power plant to be like, oh, I love coal. And they were very realistic. Like, yeah, we're going to need new energy sources. We got to ease into those. It was just a really good conversation with all those folks.
Yeah. Well, wonderful stories. I would encourage everyone who's listening right now to check out all your reporting about New Richmond, Ohio, New Richmond, Ohio.
That's right.
On our website, wvxu.org, because it's terrific and there's a lot of good stuff there.
Thanks.
Yeah. I've been talking with General Assignment and long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you so much for your time today, Nick.
Thanks, Lucy. Always great.
Yeah. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. And this lovely theme music you hear was composed by Rob Fetters. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you.